So, Robert, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, I had really not much of an idea. The nearest I could come to anything would be a disc jockey on a country radio station somewhere in the South.
And how did you come to become an economist?
Well, that was a tortuous road. I originally studied physics and engineering and was good enough at it to keep going, but not good enough at it to really want to keep going. And I eventually dropped out of that and shifted over to economics, and I did that for about 12 years altogether. And then I discovered the Alexander technique.
And did you get a master's or a PhD in economics?
I have a master's and a like an almost PhD. I never wrote a thesis, but yeah, advanced graduate work, I guess you could say.
And how did you discover the Alexander technique?
I was living in Toronto, and there was a magazine there, kind of a city magazine, came out monthly. And it had an article about the one teacher in Canada at the time. And it was quite a good article, actually. It was about him and it was about the technique. I'd never heard of it before. And I was very intrigued. I wasn't quite intrigued enough to call at the moment, but I put it aside. And then, about, a few months later, a colleague at work, it turned out, was taking Alexander lessons. So that intrigued me, and I could see changes in her. And then eventually I thought, well, I'll just go and check it out. And I did, and got hooked pretty quickly.
So, what was the year that you first saw the article, and how long till you took your first lesson?
The article was, I think in 1975, I think I probably early 75, I took my first lesson sometime in late November, maybe 1975.
And how did you come to decide to train to teach the technique?
Well, I was going for lessons once a week, maybe sometimes twice. And I was really noticing some pretty dramatic changes. And I also, the teacher also had these sort of group things in his studio, and they weren't exactly Alexander classes. I later realized they were kind of Feldenkrais things, but in any event, I met a number of his other students that way, and his way of teaching was, he did have individual lessons, but the time frame was very fluid, and often there would be overlaps, and you could be around for other people's lessons part of the time. And I just saw the changes, and I just, to me, it just seemed like a lot more interesting and useful than the work I was doing. I was working for the government of Ontario, and it was a fun job. But it was also a job that was clearly not doing anything useful for anybody. So I thought this sounds a lot better, and I figured it was a good way to get more Alexander work, which I was getting a bit greedy for.
Was there a aha moment when you first realized that this stuff was powerful?
There was a couple of aha moments. The first one was the day after my first lesson when I went out for a walk. It was kind of chilly weather. I had a heaviest jacket on, and I noticed that periodically my hands would come out of my jacket pocket, which is where I normally kept them, probably clenched pretty tightly, knowing me at that time, and they would just fall out. And I put them back in, and in a few minutes they'd fall out. And I was very curious about that because it had never happened before. And I guess I sort of thought it had something to do with the lesson, but I wasn't sure. And the big aha moments occurred in the next few weeks when I gained almost an inch in height. My clothes didn't fit. And I noticed all sorts of pretty dramatic changes in my physical being. So I was totally convinced that the technique was something that was useful and powerful. I had almost no understanding of what it was, but I knew it was a good thing.
Were you ever physically gifted at anything physical?
No, not particularly. Nor particularly interested in the whole issue.
What was your reputation in high school?
I was a nerd before nerds were cool.
And where did you train in England for 3 years?
I went over in I guess it was 77. I went over to just look at the various training courses, and there were four possibilities in England, and I very quickly fastened on to a course run by Paul and Betty Collins. It was an offshoot of Walter Carrington's training course. He had a huge waiting list to get on his, and he had sort of encouraged Paul and Betty to start their own course, and he endorsed it and occasionally came and visited it and so on. And the atmosphere there was quite different from the other courses that I visited. It was much more easygoing. There were more Americans and actually as Australians on it. And it just seemed like a much easier going environment than some of the others. And largely on that basis, that's where I went.
What did you appreciate and not appreciate about those 3 years?
To be honest, it was hardly anything I didn't appreciate. It was some of the most interesting 3 years of my life. I loved the course. I also went and had lessons with everybody I could find in London of different lineages. I used to go down to McDonald's course every semester for a day. Had lessons with Walter. I had lessons with everybody who anyone recommended. And in fact, I actually more or less did a second training course at the same time informally with a teacher who had trained with McDonald but had an interesting variation on his style. I just maxed out on Alexander and loved it.
Who was that teacher?
Her name was Elka DeVries. I have no idea what happened to her. She had trained with McDonald, and she had a reputation of being very good amongst a small group of people. I happened to find out about her, and her work was very powerful, very different from the training course I was on. And about halfway through my own training course, I came out to Lincoln to take one of Marge Barstow's workshops. And I immediately, or almost immediately, realized that she was in a different league than any of the teachers in London. And I knew that I would eventually study a lot more with her, which I did.
What was special about Marge?
Well, the initial pull was I'd heard she worked with groups. And I was curious how she did that, because it always seemed to me that, you know, a teacher only has two hands, and how are you going to work with a large group of people? And so that was the main, and plus the whole issue of group work or working with groups in London at that time was a very contentious issue. There were some very nasty meetings of STAT about that. and I just was curious how she did it. And it turned out that how she did it was basically working with people's thinking, using her hands to supplement it, of course, but she could work. I mean, the first workshop I took with her, there were about 25 people, I would guess. And that was actually a relatively small workshop for her. It went on for 14 straight days over New Year's, Christmas, New Year's period. It was very intense, 5-6 hours a day. She was 80 at the time, on her feet most of the day. And it was just an astonishing experience. But I realized that the group work thing was just part of what made her unique. Her whole way of relating to people, getting people to start thinking for themselves right at the very beginning, was quite different from anything I had experienced up until then. I immediately saw in her style of teaching something that I wanted to get as much of as I could, and that I realized that is how I wanted to teach myself when I started teaching.
If Marge has a successor, who is it?
Oh, there is no successor to Marge. There are a couple of pretenders I can think of, but there is no successor. Absolutely no successor to Marge, in my opinion.
So what was your attitude when these nasty Alexander fights would rage around you at staff meetings and
Well,
et
I was a student. I was, you know, it was like I was a student. I saw a side of the Alexander teaching profession that was not pretty. I saw that. I had seen that already because when I first went to London, I had this idea that, okay, London is the center of the world for the Alexander technique, and all of these teachers, you know, they'd all be part of this project and cooperating and so on, and nothing could be further from the truth. They were, many of them were bad-mouthing each other, and there were these feuds that apparently went back to the 30s, and some of them had to do with who was going to marry Marjorie Barlow and all kinds of craziness, when the group work thing kind of burst onto the scene, there was one meeting I can remember. It was kind of an open meeting for students and teachers, and I was just astonished at the level of nastiness, and I thought, wow, this isn't quite the serene profession I had thought it might be. But it didn't personally bother me so much as I just realized, okay, that's the way it is, at least that's the way it was in London at that time. I don't think there's anything quite like that today, certainly not in the States as far as I know. It was pretty nasty.
How much of the ethos of Alexander technique teaching comes just from the British middle classes where the technique evolved?
Oh, well, I don't really know. I don't really quite know how to answer it. I mean, in England at that time, I guess it's fair to say that it was a sort of a slightly elitist process in that you didn't get a lot of working class students. In England, although I think there were some. Marge, here in Nebraska, she had quite a variety of students that cut across everything. I don't know how much more I can say about that because I don't actually know enough of the history of the development of the technique in England to really answer that.
Is Alexander technique hands-on work? Is that erotic?
Erotic?
Yeah.
Not as far as I'm concerned. No.
Is it body work?
Oh, I don't know. I think most Alexander teachers don't like that word. Marge used to always say it was brain work more than anything else. I mean, teachers do use their hands to help reinforce what they're talking about. But I mean, if you really take seriously Alexander's idea of mind and body, that they're two aspects of the same thing, then if something's mind work, it is body work, and vice versa. So I'm not terribly bothered by those categories myself. A lot of those categories have kind of come into their own via the internet, because there are these, you know, there's a great tendency to want to lump things under various subheadings. And so body work gets to be a subheading. Alternative medicine gets to be a subheading, complementary medicine, so on. And it's very difficult to fit the Alexander technique into those categories, but that's where it often ends up. So some people get very upset about that. Personally, I'm really not that bothered by it, as long as teachers are clear with their students that they're teachers and not therapists.
How did you get established as a teacher?
Well, I was living in Toronto before I left, and I came back to Toronto. And as it happened, where I lived and taught was very close to Royal Conservatory of Music and the University of Toronto Music School. And so almost right away, I had a lot of musicians as students. And it was kind of a little bit surprised me. I mean, I have no musical background myself other than country music. And, you know, I'm not a musical kind of guy, really. But on the other hand, all the directors of my training course in England were musicians. And they were all people who were quite comfortable working with musicians as they played using the Alexander technique, which sounds pretty tame today, but at that time, a lot of teachers then in England would have said, no, you don't ever do anything like that. It promotes end gaining, blah, blah, blah. We just do the chair work and table work and so on. So I was equipped to do it, and I ended up, a lot of my early students were musicians. It was actually quite easy for me to get started in Toronto.
So I was listening to an interview with John Nichols by Paul Cook of Direction Journal,
mm-hmm.
And Paul's first question for John was, what's the principal problem facing Alexander teachers in the world today? And John said, a lack of clients. Would you agree?
I believe it's true that most teachers don't have as many clients as they would like. That's certainly my impression. I'm not sure I would characterize that. I think I would go a step back and ask why they don't have enough clients. I mean, the thing is that if you go through a 3-year training course, anyone who goes through a 3-year training course knows that the technique is useful and powerful, and that an awful lot of people could benefit from it. So potentially there should be thousands of times as many clients as maybe currently exist. And I think that one of the reasons why so many teachers don't have enough clients is they haven't really thought through the question of how is someone going to find out about the technique in a way that makes sense to them, and then how are they going to find a particular teacher in their area. And I think as a group, collectively, with lots of exceptions, Alexander technique teachers are extremely bad at both of those. And I think if you know, to I think that is a major reason why John's statement is probably true in one sense. But I don't think it's the fundamental issue. I think the fundamental issue is that teachers have not figured out how to get the word out about the technique and about themselves in an effective way.
So aside from having a website that doesn't have a lot of skeletons and pictures of F.M. Alexander and pictures of the teacher with his hand around a student's neck,
That's a big aside, though, you know. There are an awful lot of sites like that. It's unbelievable. Aside from that, and mentioning on your website where you are in the world, or even having the term Alexander Technique anywhere near the top of your site, or aside from having a site that is so poorly designed or so amateurishly designed that no one's going to take you seriously.
Aside from that,
as is true for most teachers, not even having a website. Yeah, go on, carry on.
Aside from that, what are the aside from that, biggest obstacles to a teacher getting clients?
Sorry, what was the question again? What was my
aside
advice
from those minor details we mentioned, what are the biggest obstacles to teachers getting enough clients so that they can make a living teaching what they love, the Alexander Technique?
Well, I mean, I think a fundamental thing is that most teachers have not really thought through how someone can be interested in what this work is about and what can be useful for. And I think partly it's the fact that if you're immersed in a 3-year training course surrounded by people who just take it all for granted as being good, you have to step out of that box and pretend like you've never heard of it and bear in mind that there are a zillion competing methods out there that all promise things that sound remarkably similar to the untrained ear as the Alexander Technique. So I think a lot of it is just being able to convey the basic Alexander ideas to the public in a way that would motivate the public to find out more. And I think most teachers are very poor at that. I believe I was very poor at that when I first started. I look back on some of the articles I wrote back in the 80s, and I think it's amazing that anyone ever actually read these or took them seriously. I think you have to really put yourself outside of yourself and pretend that you don't know about this, and how are you going to explain it to people in a way that's going to motivate them? But I also think, you know, getting back to the website thing, I mean, the web right now, I mean, when I started, there was no internet, so that was not an issue. But at the moment, the internet is the main way for anybody to get clients, and to not be there is pretty much equivalent to not having a phone number at this point. In fact, it's slightly worse than not having a phone number. If you had to choose one or the other, I'd drop the phone number or drop the landline and get a cheap voice over internet service and do with that, use that money to get your website up, because that's really how you're going to find clients today. That and word of mouth, you know, and some local promotion, certainly, you know, bulletin boards and local health food store and all that kind of stuff. But I'd say that's pretty secondary these days.
How have you balanced your desire to write and say what you think with, I presume, a desire to have good relationships with your fellow teachers?
I used to worry a lot more about that than I do now. I used to be very concerned about that and not say anything that I thought would go against Alexander dogma. But I've come to realize that Alexander dogma is pretty fluid and can be, and some of it didn't make a lot of sense. I don't really worry about that anymore. I have my way of looking at the technique and how it fits in and how I see it, and I don't think I'm doing anything outrageous, but I suppose, well, I know there are some teachers who would think anyone who's working even a hint of the Marge tradition would be suspect. I know that there are teachers like that. And I really could care less. It doesn't make any difference to me. I mean, one advantage I have here is there really are no other teachers here. I have one colleague in Omaha who teaches in a very similar way than I do, so we work together a lot. And I don't have any, like, immediate, people to criticize me locally, so I don't really worry about it.
Why do you live in Lincoln, Nebraska?
Well, that's where Marge lived, and I came out here to when she sort of retired at age 90 and didn't want to travel anymore. I came out here to organize workshops for her here, and I met someone and got married, so that's why I'm here. And I never imagined I'd be living here, but it's a really nice place. I still teach in Toronto on a regular basis, and I find Lincoln's a really pleasant place to live.
Could you elaborate on a statement I heard you say that you learn more about freeing your neck from craniosacral work than from Alexander technique?
Yeah, boy. Well, it's true. I mean, I've been someone who's explored other modalities for quite some time. I've done a lot of Feldenkrais work. I've been Rolfed. I've had a few Traeger sessions. I'm trying to think what else I've done. But the modality. Oh, and also I've done some physical therapy related work, but it's not standard PT, but that's a kind of a specialized physical therapy work. But the method that has intrigued me the most outside of the Alexander technique for me has been cranial sacral work, and my take on cranial work is that it can get at very subtle tensions, very subtle patterns of tension that are way below any possibility of direct consciousness and redirection on your part, and also very complicated little fascial twists and turns that I think in theory you could direct yourself out of them, but it might take a few hundred lifetimes to do it. And I found that for me, it's very complementary to Alexander work. It gets at the very deep, complex patterns that I don't think Alexander directions as a practical matter can get to that easily. And I found that I actually really got to a point where I felt my neck was a lot freer, largely from cranial work. So that's just the fact. That was my experience. Now, not everyone would have that experience, but that was mine. And I think partly because the tension in my neck that was so complicated. It wasn't simple. It was very twisty. It had all kinds of odd components to it. I don't know whether that's I think maybe it was a bit atypical, but I'm not sure. But the cranial work really, really helped me with that.
Were you able to re-experience your birth?
Not particularly. A couple of times, maybe, very slight intimations of that. But, you know, cranial work is not a rebirthing process per se. I did get some sense of where the certain chronic holding patterns in my body might have, that probably they probably did have some relationship to birth. I think, you know, I was born in the era of forceps delivery, and I can sort of imagine what happened with one shoulder being caught and so on. But I have no basis of proving that. So I didn't re-experience the birth, but I had some sense of the connection, let's put it that way.
I was doing an interview with Jeremy Chance, conducted by Paul Cook, and Jeremy said when he was having business problems about, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, he hired a consultant. And the consultant told him the first thing you need to do is change the name, that the name Alexander Technique just doesn't work. And so that's how he came up with Body Chance.
Well, I can see that. I once had a businessman here in Lincoln, a student of mine once said something fairly similar. And he said, you know, an ideal name. In America, there's a company called Kelvinator, I think. He used that as an example. They make refrigerators and freezers and so on. He said it was perfect. It had elements of refrigerator, elements of Kelvin, the Sub-Zero guy in there and everything. And, you know, it could be true, but I don't think at this point it's really possible to change it, especially with the Internet. The Internet has even wiped out Alexander Method, pretty much, which was a potential competitor maybe 20, 25 years ago. The fact is that Alexander Technique is now the term. And, you know, we get a lot of benefits when there's some, like just a few days ago, Johns Hopkins University Medical School had a little piece saying how the Alexander Technique could be useful for back pain. They had a terrible description of the technique, but they had the name. And, you know, that's going to provide some benefit for Alexander teachers. I think that's the name now. I don't think it really can be changed. I mean, Jeremy was operating in Japan primarily, where the name may not have had as much resonance, you know, been around that long, so he could a bit reinvent himself. But in terms of terminology, but I don't think he eliminated the term Alexander Technique from his PR stuff. I'm not sure about that. He's made sure to be listed on Alexander websites and so on. So I just don't think it's possible. I think an individual teacher can have a name for their practice that, you know, suits them, but if they don't have the phrase Alexander Technique up at the top of their website, they're going to lose a lot of hits. I think it's too late to change it as a practical matter.
How did you find your role in the Alexander community?
I don't know what my role is in the Alexander community. Maybe you could tell me, and then I could tell you. I mean,
I think you mentioned you used to put your efforts into writing essays.
Well, I early on I did a lot of writing, and I wrote a book that was not terribly successful. I wish I had done it differently. I've written a lot of I went through a period a few years ago of writing a lot of short articles, many of which are still kind of circulating around the Internet. I personally don't find that as interesting anymore. I'm more interested in audio in interviews. I do a lot of those. I think to me that's more, it just suits my personality better. And in terms of the internet in general, I wasn't the first person to have a website, for example. There were others. But what I noticed when I first visited the internet, which was sometime in 96, and of course I did a little search for the Alexander Technique, and there were like 5-6 sites. And it just struck me that, first of all, I was surprised there were so few, and also the ones that were there all seemed to assume that you knew what it was. And I thought, that's strange. It really, there ought to be something for someone who doesn't know what it is. And that's how I initially got started. And I've always had that in the back of my mind. Whenever I interview somebody, for example, I always ask them to give their description of the Alexander Technique. I would never assume that someone listening has any idea what it is. So that's a kind of a long answer to your question, but...
That's great. What do you see as the biggest issues in the Alexander world today?
Oh, I mean, like Alexander politics kind of issues, or... When you say issues...
You can replace the word issues with problems. Challenges.
Well, I think that what we talked about earlier, just getting the word out there more effectively is a big one. Making use of what has been done. All the things I talked about before, you know, basically utilizing the systems that are out there. And right now, the system that's out there that's just crying out to be used is the internet. I mean, if you went back in time, say, 20 years, 1990, we're talking in 2011, you went back to 1990, 91, and as an Alexander teacher, if someone were to ask you, well, what would be the most useful thing that that could come along that would help the Alexander world? And someone said, well, how about a system that lets everyone be connected instantly and pretty much free, that allows, you know, a relatively small group of people scattered around the world to connect with each other, to reinforce each other's work, to get the word out there in a coordinated way, to make it available to anyone in the world very quickly and basically for free, all the stuff that the internet does, that would have been seen as a gigantic gift to a profession like the Alexander Technique. But, you know, relatively small number of practitioners, relatively coherent and geographically dispersed. And so the gift was given, but it hasn't really been fully received. It's sad to see. And the gift keeps getting bigger, you know, with social media, YouTube, etc. And it keeps getting largely rejected. So I don't know. To me, the biggest problem is failure to take advantage of opportunities. I find that very disappointing about Alexander teachers, because we're supposedly very, very adaptable, you know, we don't have preconceived ideas, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to see preconceived ideas, talk to Alexander teachers about the web. I mean, I see that all the time. They have weird and strange preconceived ideas that they're unwilling to examine. I'm sure you've run into that out there in L.A.
Yeah.
And I've talked, I mean, I know it's not just me. I've talked to people all over about that, and it is pretty general. There are a bunch of teachers who are fully out there in various ways, but I would say that number is pretty small. Probably, I'm just guessing now, certainly less than 50, and they're like whatever it is, 4,000 Alexander teachers or more, that's not a good showing. I mean, you're there, you're out there churning out videos constantly, right?
Yep.
You know, I mean, you have your colleague out there in L.A., Sharon Jacobisi, constantly out there on social media and with videos and so on. You know, you have, there are a number of examples of people who have made full and powerful use of what's available, but it's a pretty small number. It's an unbelievably small number, given how many teachers there are in the world.
Do you think Alexander Technique could ever become a mass movement like yoga or Pilates?
I don't know. There was a book I read recently called The Big Om. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, about the birth of yoga in America. And by the way, the birth of yoga in America could be said to have taken place right here in Lincoln, Nebraska, believe it or not, is basically one guy who kind of a little bit Alexander-ish in a way, who was kind of single-handedly brought all the elements that people in the West think of as yoga, in a, you know, the mats, carrying around the little mats and this and that. He's the one who created that format, and it was one guy. So it's certainly possible that if you had the right personalities, the right people in the right place, the technique could become a lot better known, and there's certainly enough teachers to support a considerable expansion. Although I could see problems if it expanded too fast. I think it's possible. I do think it's possible. But I'm not seeing any signs of it.
Isn't it too demanding for it to become a mass movement? I mean, yeah.
What was the one you asked about?
Isn't as Alexander Technique too demanding to ever become a mass movement?
Oh,
like yoga,
I don't
you can
think
go
so.
Do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, well, yeah, I actually don't think so. I think that this gets into some tricky areas, and here is probably where I'll offend some people, but I think the technique can be taught in a far more simple form than it is typically taught, and much more direct, much more simple, and it's demanding in the sense that you do have to do some thinking and experimenting, but I think it can be presented in a way that is nowhere near as problematic as the way it is the way the technique is normally taught. My experience is, and I my preference is always to work with groups, particularly large groups, and I don't see any reason why you can't get a group of 30 or 40 people doing some pretty advanced thinking on their own after a few days if you approach it in the right way. So demanding, yes. I mean, you know, to go back to cranial sacral work, which is my favorite extracurricular therapy, so to speak, that is not demanding. It's true. You just lie on the table and you can go to sleep and it's fine. And I like that about it, quite honestly. But I think that the Alexander technique can be taught in ways that engage people's thinking, but doesn't seem like a huge big deal. That I guess that's how I would phrase it.
John Nichols says that our jargon is off-putting. Well,
oh,
let's
yeah.
talk about what
yeah,
do you think?
Inhibition's certainly not a word you want to toss out right at the beginning. I mean, we can thank Freud for that. It's too bad Alexander got it first, but yeah, I think the jargon is end gating, well, all that stuff means whereby. I think those are all phrases that can be brought to bear at some point, but my sense is that some teachers are kind of trapped by that terminology in how they think about and how they teach the technique. But that's from what I can see of other teachers, I see that sometimes. Yeah, it's not great terminology for the general public.
So how much can you teach the technique in a group class? I mean, what will people come away with?
I think you can teach it all. You can teach it all in a group class. That's my opinion. And you could even do it without any hands-on work if you're really, really good. I don't think I could do that. I think I need to rely a bit on my hands. But I don't use my hands a lot in teaching groups. Marge hardly used her hands at all sometimes. But when she did, man, you really got the message. I think hands have become fetishized. Is that the word?
Yeah.
By Alexander teachers. Of course, it's useful. Of course, it's useful to have that reinforcement and clarification of the verbal message. But I don't see them as absolutely essential. I remember Paul Collins once telling me that he was the director of my training course in England. He said that what he had heard about Frank Pierce Jones, who's kind of a legacy teacher in our field, he said apparently Frank did not have very good hands, Alexander-wise. And I don't know whether that's true or not because I never met him. But he said Frank was able to engage a student's thinking in a way that most other teachers couldn't. And that's exactly what I would say about Marge, although she also did have spectacularly good hands.
Should Jerome Staring's work matter to Alexander teachers?
I think so. Maybe we should say a word or two about who this guy is. He's a Dutch sort of independent researcher, anthropologist, studied Alexander, somehow got just fascinated with the Alexander technique and became very critical of some of Alexander's views, particularly with regard to some of the racist comments in his books and all sorts of stuff like that. And he's kind of set out on a mission to expose those aspects of the technique. And it's hard to say. To me, he has done some very solid research. And I think Alexander teachers are making a big mistake to just ignore all that stuff. I don't agree with him that the technique is fatally polluted by these discoveries, but I think we make a big mistake not to understand what kind of a person he was and what he was good at and what he wasn't good at and how his personal views may have affected the transmission of the work over the years. I mean, the way you learn the Alexander technique is very close contact with a small group of teachers. And it seems to me that it's inevitable that their stuff is going to get transmit it to you. Now, you may be smart enough to reject it or to be conscious of it, but I think there are certain attitudes in the Alexander teaching profession that are probably still a bit influenced by FM himself. Just as I would say among the teachers who train with Marge Barstow, she had certain attitudes that weren't totally healthy, and you see traces of that amongst her teachers. I think it's inevitable. So I think it's important to just see what, you know, kind of look at the people like Alexander in a very, be a bit detached and be prepared to find out some things about him that aren't so great. Personally, I kind of like Alexander. I think he's the kind of guy I'd like to hang out with. But he certainly had some retrograde attitudes. I mean, they weren't uncommon at the time, but you read his comments about the Ku Klux Klan and blacks in the South, and it's pretty embarrassing, really. And he had some weird ideas. And we just need to make sure that we don't take that stuff on without, you know, we don't inadvertently take any of that on ourselves.
Did F.M. Alexander discover anything important?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, whether he was the first person to ever discover these things, who knows? I don't know, but I think he did make some extremely important discoveries about human functioning, and did it probably, given who he was, pretty good job of packaging it in a way that could get it to survive, you know, and long enough that it could kind of survive on its own without him. That's quite an accomplishment.
Well, reading Staring, I don't get the sense that F.M. discovered anything, but that rather he ripped it off from other people.
Right.
And
yeah,
was a great street fighter.
Yeah, there. I mean, you can find all the Alexander procedures, everything from hands on back of chair, table work, all that stuff. You can find someone else who was doing something that looked an awful lot like that. I'm sure he ripped off consciously and unconsciously stuff. It's hard to imagine he wouldn't have. He at one point he held himself out as a, I'm not sure I know how to pronounce this properly, Delacroix teacher. He was very influenced by that. I think he was a bit of a synthesizer in that sense, but I think his understanding of the connection between thought and movement, I think that was something that he actually discovered for himself. That's my sense. The stuff that he could say may or may not have ripped off from other people are some of his teaching procedures. Now, personally, I don't think the teaching procedures have much of an importance at all. I know there are teachers who disagree strongly with that. I know at least one teacher who thinks that the procedures are the core element of the work. I would disagree totally with that. I think the procedures are just procedures. And I think Alexander made it very clear several times we have quotes from Marjorie Barlow about him saying to students on his training course, well, I want you to watch what I'm doing. I want you to understand why I'm doing it. And then I want you to figure out your own way to do it. He said, I don't want a bunch of monkeys copying me. And I don't think there's any clear way of expressing that interest on his part. He wanted people to figure out their own ways of conveying the work and their own ways of developing the work. He also said, you know, that he was just the beginning. He was just pointing in a direction. And I think that idea of how important it is to understand how your thinking affects your movement, I think that was a genuine discovery of his based on his practical, you know, the needs of his situation at the time.
So does the myth of FM losing his voice and then sitting in a room with mirrors and uncovering these essential principles of the technique, does that play a bigger role in the teaching of Alexander technique than the story of the founders of, say, Pilates or Feldenkrais?
I don't really know, because I think my sense of Pilates it's become today almost totally dissociated from anything Pilates himself would have recommended or thought was any good. Feldenkrais, I just don't know. What was his thing, a parachute ball that broke his leg or something? I don't know what his creation story is. Alexander's, I think there was some truth in it. I imagine the mirror part is accurate. I think the part that we really should drop from the storyline is that it took 10 years. For some reason, that number, or nine, some people say 9 years, that number, I just took it for granted for many years. It was just the number. But when you actually go and look at the timeline, it's a lot closer to 2 or 3 years.
Or even 18 months.
Could be. And that changes a lot, because that means, hell, anyone can do that, you know? I mean, he said anyone can do what I did if they'll do what I did. It takes it out of the realm of this thing where, gee, the founder took 10 years to figure it out, and now teachers need to train for 3 years to get the skills to teach it, which I think actually the 3 years is not a bad length. But it takes away a lot of the sort of mystery and the unattainability of it unless you take lots of lessons kind of idea. I just don't buy any of that. I totally disagree with all of that. I think there are people who can learn everything they need in 2 or 3 lessons or 2 or 3 group classes, and what they might need might not seem what you think they should need, but if they're happy, you know, I'm happy. So,
what do you find, what do you love, what do you hate about teaching Alexander technique?
Well, you get to meet a lot of different kinds of people, that's for sure. Quite a range of lifestyles and personalities. You learn a lot about human nature. I don't know that there's a lot I don't like. I sometimes find it frustrating when a student makes a bit of progress and finds it, and then a very common pattern in Alexander teaching, and again, Paul Collins talked about this many years ago. He once said that when you're working with a new student, the most dangerous point is when they make a big breakthrough and they notice it. Because at that point, they kind of come up against, he didn't say this, but my theory is that people come up against the truth of the fact that they are actually responsible for themselves. And not everyone really wants to know about that or hear about that. And so some people, that's the very point at which they stop taking lessons. And I feel very sad about that. I guess another frustrating thing about being an Alexander teacher for me is when I see kids who are clearly messing up themselves with the way they're standing and moving, young kids, and you just know in 20 years they're going to have all kinds of problems probably. But you can't just go in there and tell their parents, you know. You can't say to their parents, you know, maybe if you're setting a bad example for them or whatever it is. You don't really have, you're not in that position that you can do that. And I find that kind of frustrating. So But by and large, I think being an Alexander Technique teacher is a great occupation.
Do you find it difficult to stay present when I assume you're saying the same things, you know, over and over again, lesson after lesson?
I've never had that problem. I try to approach each person, each lesson, completely fresh. You know, I'll typically ask a new student or a student's come back for a second or third or whatever lesson, I'll ask if, you know, what's happened since the previous. Have they done any experiments? What have they noticed? I'm pretty much in the moment. I try to be. And, you know, I'm always, I don't have a lesson plan. I try to just respond to the situation. I don't find that a problem. I suppose maybe for some teachers it is. I don't know.
What did your father think of your decision to get into Alexander Technique?
Well, he had no understanding of what it was, really. I mean, he did get the books. He got all four of Alexander's books and read them. And I can only imagine what he thought when he saw John Dewey's introductions, because when I was a kid, John Dewey was like a household topic of conversation between my parents. And he was, it seemed, my sense from what they were saying was he had single-handedly wrecked American education. And then suddenly, wow, Dewey is this guy who has followed me around for years. I went to university and took a introductory philosophy course, and we got to pragmatism, and there's John Dewey, the leading exponent. I thought, the same guy who'd also wrecked the school system? That's interesting. And then, you know, a few years later, John Dewey's written some really good stuff about Alexander's work. It's the same guy. And, you know, he's hardly a household name these days. Most people confuse him with one of the other Deweys, like the Dewey Decimal System guy or the guy who ran for president and so on. But, I'd say my father was not, I think it puzzled him, let's put it that way.
What did you love and hate about being the son of a great man?
Well, it had its pluses and minuses. You got certain. There were some privileges that came with that. I won't deny that, but you also got, you know, people just coming up to you and expecting that you would expecting certain things from you or certain interests on your part that were not the case. I try to downplay it as much as possible, personally.
Yeah. So what's been your relationship to Judaism?
Judaism, well, I was not brought up Jewish. I actually was, believe it or not, Presbyterian for quite a while, but not in any real sense. I dropped out of that as quickly as I could. I basically had no interest in religion. Any interest I had was in Eastern religions. I was intrigued by Buddhism in my 30s and 40s, but only intellectually. It seemed like all my girlfriends were Jewish, and I ended up moving, when I moved to Lincoln, I moved about a block away from a temple here, and made some connections there, and over the years got more and more interested, and I actually converted about 4 or 5 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the story there.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. Hang on a sec. I'm just going to press a couple of buttons.
Okay.